Daddy, give Sissy what she wants. When you're older, you'll learn girls always get what they want when they cry. You need to know these things, Johnny. It's the law.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
We're gonna stay here all night if we have to, so let's get started.
Can I go when this starts to suck?
Flashy words make the world turn, but it don't turn right.
Say what?
Flashy words make the world turn, but it don't turn right.
Say what?
So I use these real lies to realize the real lies being spoken but not heard, cause we are more fascinated by that which are fabricated.
Say what?
The iconoclastic tactless tactician aims tongue, spits truth, words like wrecking balls bounce off brains, cause nobody likes to hear what's going on these days. It's like the truth hurts, and we've been lied to, a bunch of hollowed minds living on borrowed times, and nobody likes to hear that, and nobody likes to say it either, cause lazy angels never carry their wings, and wingless words do nothing but keep us down. So this New York poet yells, there is no satisfaction in knowing that your life is one of the saddest fictions ever written. So take your not-so-satisfactory life back to the sadness factory to be reworked and to be rewritten and to be reconfigured to live right. Open your brain, let your heart go. The real you's been locked within your ribcage for too long, and stop trying to hold on to them, because that's why it all started. And about that same time, he forgot fun, she lost hope, and now we can't find anything. And I swear to God, if I could swear to God, I'd ask her, what the fuck was she thinking when she gave us free will? Because we don't fuck things up, because kids don't play and God don't pray, because it's out of her hands now. See, I've rewritten the Bible after getting over the primal rage of finding my name disguised within a Bible's page. And people trying to dissect my destiny will find that words somehow make the world turn, but it really doesn't turn right. And suddenly the world starts spinning because words weren't good enough. So I tell you, a blind man once told me the true meaning of love at first sight. So I closed my eyes and I recited this poem to an audience of one and found total gratification in my undivided attention. And when I opened my eyes, I found myself standing before a mirror, staring into the eyes of an invisible man until my pupils became pupils and I could teach myself to live a better life. Words. Words. From a peace of mind brings peace of mind, all I gotta do is give a peace of mind. One of the words, piece together the pieces in me to create peace within me. But they are all pieces. Pieces to a puzzle when it's put together is me. So let me tell you something. Don't ever do anything you're not supposed to, and speak only when spoken to, and don't speak unless you mean, because a good man is hard to find, and a hard man is good to find, and I'm half the man I used to be, and one-fourth the person I should be or could be, because I sacrificed freedom for stardom after being out of my freedom without a condom. Now, how dumb was I? Words. Break these words down to the syllables. They all are the silly bulls they represent. And what do I represent? Well, it's hard to say when my represents the fact I have to question myself, or each time that question represents itself. I can, therefore I am, and sticks and stones may break your bones, but words will always teach you.
This is the conspiratorial view of history, as opposed to the accidental view. And it is the conspiratorial view that we shall present in this program.
Seldom in our history has a presidential election campaign aroused so much interest so far in advance of the actual balloting. Just what are the major issues on which the 1952 campaign will be won or lost? Two veteran campaigners are with us today to discuss the major issues. Senator Kerr delivered the keynote address to the Democratic Convention in 44. In that same year, Senator Dirksen was a contender for the Republican vice presidential nomination. Both of our distinguished guests are being widely mentioned this year as possible candidates on the 1952 presidential ticket. Now, Senator Dirksen, what one issue do you think will emerge as a decisive factor in the current campaign?
It seems to me, of course, that the first and most important issue that emerges in the 1952 campaign is the issue of peace and war, because that is the issue of self-preservation for our country. Now, without delineating that issue for the moment, because I suppose questions will come up, then come questions of internal security, and by that I mean the pro-communist attitude in some places in government. Then comes the issue of preparedness, where there was failure in other years and where we're far behind the program. Then comes the issue of what I call blood and graveyard prosperity, of which so much has been made. Then comes the moral issue and the socialist issue and then the freedom issue. So there, in summary, I think, are some of the issues that people are already discussing and that will be roundly ventilated in the 1952 campaign.
Senator Kerr, what do you think will be the decisive issue, or one of the decisive issues?
Well, the decisive issue, of course, will be winning the peace and those things which go with winning the peace. The American people know that if we're to have the opportunity to continue our present fine prosperity and expand it with a sound economy and a continuing improved opportunity for individual citizens, we must have peace in order to do that. Therefore, they are for peace because it gives us the opportunity for continued and expanded prosperity. They are for peace because thereby we live in a better relationship with our neighbors. And there comes the issue of our foreign policy. In the final analysis, Mr. Granick, the American voter will decide the issue of 1952 on the basis of which party has best served and on the basis of its record will best serve him, his family, and his country.
Senator Dirksen, on foreign policy, just what major changes would a Republican administration make?
Well, let me elaborate just a little. We intend, of course, to go back and to ventilate that whole policy, starting, of course, with the failure of this administration to crown the victory effort in World War II. And that failure has resulted from bungling and blundering and miscalculation, from the infamous deal at Yalta and at Potsdam, that finally eventuates, of course, in the casualty list that we have in Korea today. And in it, of course, is not only this diplomatic tragedy of Yalta, but the mistakes and the miscalculations that have been made all along the line. So obviously, it is in the interest of our country that we thoroughly ventilate all the facts in connection therewith to demonstrate to the American people that this administration is just one of a succession of administrations going back 35 years that has projected us into three wars, the one in which I served and my distinguished friend from Oklahoma served, then World War II, and now the glorified and aggravated police action in Korea that they still do not call a war.
Who are you to wave your finger? You must have been out your hair.
Great to be with you again. I want you to all understand, I love this great country. I love the people in this country. I love the principles on which this great country was founded, and I don't like to see those principles violated. And believe me, they are being grossly violated at this point in our country's history by the people at the highest levels in our government. I never thought I would live to see a major drug dealer give $20,000 in Florida and then be invited to a big Democratic reception by the Vice President of the United States, Al Gore, and then be invited to the White House for a reception. Now, keep in mind, you can't get into the White House unless the Secret Service clears you. This guy had been convicted, arrested twice in the 80s. It's in the computer. Forrest Gump on the Secret Service, and they don't have one. Would have picked that up, right? But every now and then, the White House just overrule them and say, let them in anyhow. I promise you that if I am ever your president, drug dealers will not be invited to the White House. Now then, right after his trip to the White House, they caught him with 5,828 pounds of cocaine. Don't you think we should set a higher standard? I hope you do. The White House had to know about the prior arrest. They had to know about his connections to the Cali cartel. But hey, this guy gave $20,000, so let him come on in, right? The only reason there is a White House is because millions of you pay for it. Keep in mind, the president doesn't pay for the White House. He does not pay rent. You pay for the whole thing. And I am personally offended that the president is now selling the Lincoln bedroom to any $100,000 a night contributor. I think that's absolutely wrong when you think that plumbers, electricians, people working third shift provide that White House for our president, and it should not be for sale for any price. This guy they just arrested also had ties to Fidel Castro, and I'm sure the Secret Service picked up on that. Now, here's the next one, the Indonesian connection, which you maybe have read more about than you want to, but I never thought that a family in Indonesia and his wife would be able to give nearly $200,000 to the White House during the president's presidential campaign. The Riotti's dad is head of the Asian conglomerate. And what did they get in return? A man named John Wong, isn't spelled H-U-A-N-G, but pronounced Wong, was given a position in the Clinton administration overseeing trade policy. Now, doesn't that make you feel good if you're working second shift in a clothing mill somewhere down south? This guy is influencing trade policy, and where in the world do they abuse child labor more than Indonesia? Nowhere. And if you question it, go there. And if you can't find it, call me and I'll have you taken on a tour. In addition, this man was given a top secret security clearance. I can remember when that meant something. And finally, only in America, when he left the Riotti's to go to work for the government, he was given a $780,000 departure bonus. If this doesn't seem corrupt to you, then you and I are on two different planets.
Settle for a country where a shrinking number of people do really well, while a growing number of Americans barely get by. Or we can restore an economy where everyone gets a fair shot, and everyone does their fair share, and everyone plays by the same set of rules. The state of our union is getting stronger, and we've come too far to turn back now. As long as I'm president, I will work with anyone in this chamber to build on this momentum. But I intend to fight obstruction with action, and I will oppose any effort to return to the very same policies that brought on this economic crisis in the first place. Let's never forget, millions of Americans who work hard and play by the rules every day deserve a government and a financial system that do the same. It's time to apply the same rules from top to bottom. No bailouts, no handouts, and no cop-outs. An America built to last insists on responsibility from everybody.
And who cares if you disagree? You are not me. Who made you king of anything? And you dare tell me who to be? Who died and made you king of anything?
Now, because of loopholes and shelters in the tax code, a quarter of all millionaires pay lower tax rates than millions of middle-class households. Right now, Warren Buffett pays a lower tax rate than his secretary. In fact, if you're earning $1 million a year, you shouldn't get special tax subsidies or deductions. On the other hand, if you make under $250,000 a year, like 98% of American families, your taxes shouldn't go up. You're the one struggling with rising costs and stagnant wages. You're the ones who need relief. Now, you can call this class warfare all you want, but asking a billionaire to pay at least as much as his secretary in taxes? Most Americans would call that common sense. Thank you. God bless you. And God bless the United States of America.
You sound so innocent, all full of good intent. You swear you know best. But you expect me to jump up on board with you and ride off into your delusional. Nelson said, I'm not the one who's lost with no direction, no, but you'll never see. You're so busy making maps with my name on them in all caps. You got the talking down, just not the listening.
The only people who don't want to disclose the truth are people with something to hide.
An Atlanta judge orders President Obama to show up in court in Georgia. Several people in Metro Atlanta sued the president to keep him off the election ballot. It is not the first time a lawsuit has questioned the president's citizenship. But it would be the first time a judge orders the president to actually show up. Well, tonight, CBS Atlanta's Katie Brace talked with one of the men who questions the president's right to hold office.
Well, out of all the lawsuits to keep the president off the ballot, this one has gone the furthest. In this case, the judge subpoenaed the president, and the judge ordered President Obama to be here next week. If several people have their way, President Obama's name will not appear on Georgia's March primary ballot. Their efforts received a big boost Friday.
Well, it's a huge deal.
Carl Swenson is the head of Clayton County's Republican Party. He is also part of one of several lawsuits trying to keep the president off the state ballot.
Is he eligible to be on the ballot constitutionally?
Swenson is not part of the lawsuit ruled on Friday. This complaint claims Mr. Obama is not a natural-born citizen and cannot be president. A judge gave it some merit by ordering the president to appear in court.
This sends a signal to the defense counsel right now that he's going to have to comply with the rules and regulations of the state of Georgia.
A lot of people have things to hide.
And who cares if you disagree? You are not me. Who made you king of anything? Do you dare tell me?
Anybody who thinks you can't have that, you can disagree with it as a matter of philosophy, but it's not illegal. In terms of the commander-in-chief's ability to set aside rules, I would suggest you go back and look at President Lincoln and at President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. In wartime, presidents have very wide authority to do what it takes for the country to survive. As one Supreme Court justice once said, the Constitution is not a suicide pact.
Suicide!
Now, you can question the president's judgment, but I doubt very much if any of the things he personally did could be construed as illegal if they were done in his role as commander-in-chief.
Who cares if you disagree? You are not me. Who made you king of anything? Do you dare tell me who to be? Who died and made you king of anything? And who cares if you disagree? You are not me. Who made you king?
And this week in science news, a coalition of researchers has come together to say that one-third of the world's population has to die for civilization to be sustainable, adding, quote, how do we want to do this? And in other news, an embarrassed Secretary of Energy Stephen Chu accidentally calls Barack Obama dad in a cabinet meeting. The world's greatest trombonist just tells people he works in marketing. And a Ron Paul supporter likes the way the GOP candidate tells it like it has no chance of being.
The Indian government is ramping up efforts to fingerprint and iris scan the entirety of its 1.2 billion citizens in an ambitious scheme to issue national ID cards with biometric details. The plan has so far already enrolled 110 million people and issued 60 million numbers, with the aim of enrolling 200 million by this March and 600 million by 2014. The project stems from two separate, overlapping schemes: the Unique Identification Program, aimed at providing India's 200 million poorest citizens with fail-safe access to the country's welfare system, and the National Population Register, aimed at providing a national ID card to help identify and deport undocumented immigrants. Last month, the UID plan hit a roadblock when a parliamentary committee issued a blistering attack on the scheme, calling it directionless and full of uncertainty, while critics note the danger of the project in the absence of coherent privacy laws. Just how the government will use the information, or even who will have access to it, has yet to be properly determined. Although fast becoming the largest such database in the world, it is not the only government-administered repository of biometric details. Nations across the globe are increasingly turning to the collection of biometric information under a host of programs, including proposed national ID schemes like the one being implemented in India. Countries around the world are now adopting biometric passports and travel documents that use fingerprints and digital photographs to verify passenger identity. Presented as a way of streamlining and standardizing entry and exit procedures at national borders, what the public is not told is that these documents are the end result of a years-long process of coordination that has codified the technical specifications for these systems via international agreements. In addition, countries are increasingly agreeing on an infrastructure for sharing their biometric databases between each other via database sharing agreements that have received scant attention. Governments around the world are eager to tout the potential benefits of these national identification registers in glossy promotional videos depicting gleaming science fiction-like future societies of total efficiency. However, the privacy and civil liberties implications of this technology are seldom discussed.
Certainly one way to cool a heated debate, as an Israeli politician throws a glass of water over one of her counterparts in the country's parliament. The incident happened during a televised debate on education, which saw Ghaleb Mojadeli and Anastasia Mikhaeli in an enthusiastic exchange. At one point, Mojadeli tells her to shut up, to which she responds with a face full of water before storming out.
Much obliged for such a pleasant stay, but now it's time for me to go. The autumn moonlight's my way, but now I smell the rain and with it came, and it's heading my way. Sometimes I grow so tired.
Australia's Prime Minister Julia Gillard and opposition leader Tony Abbott have had a very close call after being surrounded by an angry mob in Canberra.
Shame!
We feel that the situation could deteriorate if we stay in too much longer.
Aboriginal campaigners celebrating the 40th anniversary of the Tent Embassy awareness camp in the city surrounded the restaurant at which the country's two most prominent politicians were celebrating Australia Day. Police bundled the politicians out of the restaurant and into their cars. But not before the demonstrators managed to get closer than anyone dared hope, Julia Gillard's shoe proving an unlikely trophy.
Got no time for spitting. The time has come to be gone. And though I held sweet drink a thousand times, it's time to ramble on.
getting better.
It's hard to believe US Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords was shot through the head last year. She is indeed getting better, but she's now decided to resign from the House of Representatives to focus on her recovery.
I will step down this week.
It was January the 8th last year when a gunman opened fire on her when she was meeting with her constituents in Tucson. Six people died. Jared Loughner was arrested and charged, but later deemed unfit to stand trial. In August last year, Gabrielle Giffords returned to Congress, where she was described by Nancy Pelosi as the personification of courage.
But Gollum and the evil one crept up and slipped away with her, yeah. I ain't nothing happened.
Between the US and Iran, which stands accused of developing nuclear weapons, are at an all-time high. So how about a gift to smooth things over? The US wants the Islamic Republic to return an RQ-170 spy drone downed in December. Never one to deny a gift, an Iranian toy maker has granted their request. Sort of. Ladies and gentlemen, in President Obama's apparent favourite colour, the drone, which will be presented to the US as a little gift. The return of the real item seems a long way off, so these models, which have unsurprisingly become a bit of a hit in Iran, are likely to be the best the US is going to get.
Can entertain, save energy, and the designer says they could save your life. But some say IntelliStreets should really be called spying streetlights. Fox Charlotte's Adrena Bigas takes a look at a high-tech system that could light up our area.
If I'm out, I want to just be out. I don't want to feel like I have eyes on me all the time.
It's a small invasion of privacy.
These streetlights double as surveillance. They can play music, monitor conversations, direct traffic, send emergency signals, and take pictures.
It made me feel kind of, you know, like that's kind of creepy.
The designer says the lights aren't some type of spook technology, but they can detect movement and determine whether it's a person, a car, or even an animal. And late at night, if there's too much movement, the light will notify police.
It almost looks like a scene from the science fiction movie Minority Report. A New Jersey city is going to start marking people with a red light before they might commit a crime. The police chief in East Orange, William Robinson, is embracing it as the latest pre-crime law enforcement technique.
Whereas London have talking cameras, we're about to deploy light projecting cameras, better known as light-based intervention systems.
The directed red lights will be attached to existing surveillance cameras and can shoot a light beam a full city block away. If a police officer monitoring one of the city's many high-def cameras sees a crime about to occur, like someone about to get mugged, they will remotely bathe the would-be perpetrator in red light.
The message to the criminals is, the police are observing you, the police are recording you, and the police are responding.
The oldest of its kind. It is, as far as we know, anyway. A team of paleontologists led by the University of Toronto, Mississauga, discovered a dinosaur nesting site in South Africa they believe is 190 million years old. The scientists discovered dozens of eggs, bones, and footprints in Golden Gate Highlands National Park. This image shows two embryonic Massus spondylus skeletons, a long-necked cousin of the Diplodocus. This artist's interpretation shows what the giants may have looked like. The find will help scientists understand more about the nesting and breeding habits of large dinosaurs. They think over time they'll find more nests and more revealing fossils.
Welcoming in the dragon. The Chinese celebrate the start of the Lunar New Year, lighting up the sky above the capital, Beijing. Invented by the Chinese, fireworks first believed to have been used to scare away man-eating monster, now appreciated just for themselves. New Year wouldn't be the same without them. And the Chinese love their fireworks, buying boxes and boxes of them.
Each year we buy around 70 to 80,000 yen's worth of fireworks. And every year New Year's Eve cancels out all the bad luck and negative things from last year. And it lifts all of our spirits. It's really fun.
That's around £8,000 worth of fireworks. The Lunar New Year, or the Spring Festival as it's also called, is a very important event for the Chinese. For many, it's the only holiday they get to spend with friends and family. This year is the Year of the Dragon, one of the most auspicious in the Chinese calendar. The dragon viewed in many Asian countries as a powerful mythical creature that brings good luck. Crowds not being put off by the freezing temperatures, starting 15 days of celebrations.
In my eyes, indisposed, in disguise, does no one knows, hides the face, lies the snake in the sun, in my disgrace, boiling heat, summer stench, neath the black the skies look dead, call my name through the dream, and I'll hear you scream again.
An alien world. The surface of our sun photographed by a NASA satellite, ejecting a big chunk of its atmosphere. And that bit of atmosphere is heading towards Earth. Energized solar particles are hurtling towards us at 5 million miles per hour, and they're about to cause the strongest geomagnetic storm for more than 6 years. This kind of energy can interfere with high-frequency radio comms, so some airlines may have to change some of their routes. Astronauts on board the International Space Station may also have to shield themselves in certain parts of the spacecraft to avoid a heightened dose of solar radiation.
Black hole sun, won't you come? Won't you come?
stuttering, cold and damp, steal the warm wind, tired friend. Times are gone for honest men, sometimes far too long for snakes. In my shoes, walking sleep, and my youth I pray to keep. Heaven send, hell away, no one sings like you anymore.
We're used to them appearing in places like the Arctic, Norway and Iceland, but in a rare sighting this far south, the Aurora Borealis, or the Northern Lights, are visible over large parts of Scotland and Northern England. Images taken by locals show them in stunning green, blue and pink arcs over areas of Northumberland, including Holy Island and Embleton Bay. The lights are one of nature's most spectacular displays, with experts saying they're only seen this far south once every 11 years.
Black cold sun, won't you come and wash away the rain? Black cold sun, won't you come? Won't you come? Black hole sun, won't you come? Wash away the rain. Black hole sun, won't you come? Won't you come?
Might look like something from an action movie set, but in actual fact, this is just a bridge too far. This ship, the Delta Mariner, made a fairly fatal miscalculation of its height as it tried to pass under a busy road bridge in Aurora, Kentucky. The ship ripped the 80-year-old span clean off, leaving the remains of the bridge splattered over its bow. With hindsight, there was absolutely no way that was going to fit under that. Incredibly, no one was injured in the accident.
Hang my head, drown my fear, till you all just disappear. Black hole sun, won't you come? Wash away the rain. Black hole sun, won't you come? Black hole sun, won't you come? Black hole sun, won't you come?
Calendar reform is the final act of history, and the first step toward Earth regeneration in the cradle of galactic culture. To change the calendar now is to change the course of history and to revolutionize altogether the future of civilization on Earth. In making these sweeping but accurate statements, we would be remiss if we did not present a brief history of modern calendar reform so that we may be able to better grasp the subtleties and far-reaching implications of such reform. We must also understand that the timing of this calendar reform is of a vital nature and presents an evolutionary opportunity for humanity, which it cannot afford to lose. The topic of calendars and calendar reform is not a popular one, for the simple reason that the calendar in use functions as a dogma, and therefore, there appears little reason to question it. Most people do not have any idea where the current calendar came from. People who live in mostly non-Western societies function with what is called a lunar calendar, as well as the more recent Gregorian calendar. The lunar calendars also dogmatize the sense of time. Though we speak of the Arab, Hebrew, or Chinese lunar calendars, for example, it should be kept in mind that there is only one moon, and hence all lunar calendars are actually the same measure. The lunar calendars in use measure the synodic cycle of the moon, from new moon to new moon. This is a cycle of 29.5 days. 12 of these synodic lunations take 354 days, 11 days short of the solar orbit of the Earth. The sidereal cycle of the moon, the measure of the moon from the same place it appears in the sky, is only 27.5 days. Between the synodic and sidereal measures, the mean lunar cycle is 28 days. While the lunar calendars in use by different world cultures is no way solar calendars, or a measure of the Earth's orbit, the Gregorian calendar in use today is an approximation of a solar calendar. We say approximation because on the one hand, while the Gregorian calendar accounts for the 365-day solar cycle, inclusive of one extra day every 4 years, its standard of measure is irregular and corresponds to no natural cycle whatsoever. It must be unequivocally understood that an irregular standard of measure has a profound effect on the mind, especially an irregular standard of measure of time. This is because time is a mentally perceived phenomenon, unlike space, which is perceived through the senses. A standard of measure which is irregular and uneven is inherently problematic. Our sense of time is a fundamental perception. If the standard of measure of time that we use is irregular, then we must contemplate deeply and understand what it does to our mind over centuries of prolonged use. If the clock represents the mechanization of time, the Gregorian calendar is the instrument which normalizes the mechanization of time as a mental institution, inseparable from the irrational irregularities of its monthly count. In this way, modern human civilization has acquired its quality of institutionalized machine efficiency, inseparable from a host of irrational social problems, crime and war. Aside from the Vatican itself, which preceded and sponsored the Gregorian calendar reform, virtually all of the inventions, nation-states, and institutions of the modern world are incorporated in this calendar. Any attempt to reform the current civil calendar must come to terms with everything that is incorporated in this calendar. Some 200 years after the Gregorian calendar reform came the French Revolution and the call for a new calendar. The Republican calendar of 1793 replaced the Gregorian calendar with a 12-month schedule of 30 days each, plus a 5-day period at the end of the year. The French Republican calendar was essentially the same as a Babylonian type, which had the same way of dividing the year into 12 30-day months, with a 5-day purification cycle at the end. Every 4 years, this 5-day period of the French Republican calendar was extended to 6 days, to account for the quarter day. The 7-day week was replaced by the Decalogue, or 10-day cycle. The French Republican calendar lasted 10 years, until 1803, when it was replaced by the Gregorian calendar once again. The anti-ecclesiastical, pro-rationalist sentiment which animated the French Republican calendar was also behind the proposed calendar reform of the 19th-century French thinker Auguste Comte, 1798-1857. Best known as the founder of the modern discipline of sociology, philosopher and mathematician Auguste Comte had the opportunity in the 1840s of learning about a calendar of 13 months of 20 days each. This information came from travelers who had been to Tahiti, where this calendar was well known among the Polynesians. This universal indigenous calendar so impressed Comte by its harmonic form and biological truthfulness that he devoted several years to studying it before he finalized its form as the Positivist Calendar, presented at an 1849 session of the Positivist Society. Apart from Comte's proposal for a 13-month calendar, which of necessity observes an extra day out of time, the call for calendar reform continued in France and elsewhere in Europe, but with a focus on maintaining a 12-month cycle and a 7-day week. During the 1890s, there was considerable agitation for a new calendar to begin the 20th century. In 1900, a conference was organized in Eisenach. In 1900, a conference was organized in Germany for the study of the reform of the Gregorian calendar. Throughout these efforts, the papal response was always very intense in the defense of the current calendar for liturgical reasons. But a further defense put forth by the Vatican was that any calendar reform had to respect the succession of the seven-day week. This argument of the Vatican very much restricts or even deadlocks the debate on calendar reform, and essentially functions as a catch-22, which says, yes, you can reform the calendar, but only so long as there is no break in the succession of the seven-day week, and that there are 12 months. Anyone skilled at problem-solving will see that these guidelines very much limit the possibilities of calendar reform, and in fact, have been the cause of a lack of success of every effort at calendar reform in the last 150 years. Indeed, all that this argument really amounts to is an expression of the power of the Catholic Church to maintain its calendar as the world standard.
America's expanding waistline proves the country's love affair with food, but almost as much as is consumed is being dumped in the trash every day. That's despite statistics saying millions in the country are now struggling to put anything on the dinner plate. RT's Marina Portnaya met the so-called dumpster divers. They say that a few minutes of raking through the garbage can deliver a simple banquet.
The number of people on food stamps has reached an all-time high.
More and more people are going hungry.
One in three Americans live in or near poverty.
And suffering hunger in this land of plenty.
In this land of plenty, roughly 2.7 million tons of food is reportedly raised and grown each year. The same country that loves so much to consume calories also loves to waste them.
How come you're always such a fussy young man? Don't want no Captain Crunch, don't want no Raisin Bran. Well, don't you know that other kids are starving in Japan? So eat it, just eat it. Don't wanna argue, I don't wanna debate. Don't wanna hear about what kind of food you hate. You won't get no dessert till you clean off your plate. So eat it, don't you tell me you're full. Just eat it, eat it. Get yourself an egg and beat it. Have some more chicken, have some more pie. It doesn't matter if it's boiled or fried. Just eat it, just eat it, just eat it, just eat it.
Gio Andolo is a dumpster diver.
Bread.
Instead of paying for food, he rummages through garbage bags on the streets of New York City.
Here's another cheese slice.
Where tons of edible food is thrown out each night.
I've never found this many slices of pizza here. This is a, looks like a raisin bagel.
The 27-year-old musician makes his way from the bakery to the deli.
There's hot food here, which probably comes from a hot food bar.
Relying on supermarket trash for his essential vitamins.
Even without opening the bag, I can see that there's an orange, apples, parsnip and some other greens.
What we and those crowding around Geo see is that in a country where more than 40 million people struggle daily to get enough food, millions of meals are literally being wasted.
Because this food, as you can see, is still perfectly edible, and there's no sense that it should be wasted and thrown away.
Your table manners are a crying shame. You're playing with your food to send some kind of game. Now if you starve to death, you'll just have yourself to blame. So eat it, just eat it. You better listen, better do what you're told. You haven't even touched your tuna casserole. Ooh! You better chow down or it's gonna get cold. So eat it, I don't care if you're full. Just eat it, eat it. Open up your mouth and feed it.
estimated 30 to 50% of U.S. food produced for consumption ends up at landfills each year. That comes at an annual cost of $1 billion. Simultaneously, food prices continue to rise, leaving millions more online at soup kitchens and ultimately searching through trash.
Getting meat for my baby shower tomorrow.
The documentary Dive follows filmmaker Jeremy Seifert and his friends in the back alleys and rubbish piles of Los Angeles as thousands of dollars worth of edible food is salvaged.
It's a result of our excess. We are a wealthy country and we have excess, and so waste is really necessarily a byproduct of excess, and it's a bad habit of sort of the spoiled rich kid, as it were.
Amid America's expanding climate of food waste, critics say the country's overall carelessness causes ripple effects around the world. Supersized crisis, impossible for America to disguise. An insatiable love for food and big portions has served up a nationwide majority of overweight children.
None of us wants this future for our kids.
As First Lady Michelle Obama attempts to tackle the epidemic by advocating more exercise, healthy eating, and penning a book about the White House garden, U.S. lawmakers are getting kudos for stirring the health problem.
Her efforts, which I applaud and I think are well-intentioned, I fear will go nowhere, as given the allure that fast foods have and the recent decision by the Congress to say pizza was a vegetable.
You heard correctly. The greasy, cheesy, cheap meal known as pizza is served as a lunch vegetable to 32 million public school children. How? Because U.S. Department of Agriculture guidelines qualify 2 tablespoons of tomato paste as an official veggie serving.
Eat it, if it's getting cold, reheat it. Have a big dinner, have a light snack. If you don't like it, you can't send it back. Just eat it.
Okay, let's start off in Washington, where Deputy FDA Commissioner Steve Hoyer made an announcement today urging Americans to, quote, just eat a goddamn vegetable once in a while.
You just buy a bag of f***ing carrots and you eat them the way you'd normally eat a package of hot dogs, okay? If you usually stand in front of an open fridge door shoving them in your fat face cold, well then just do that with a carrot. It's that f***ing simple.
Being a prisoner is designed to be tough, but for those interned in the former Soviet Republic of Kyrgyzstan over the frozen winter months, conditions, they say, have become unbearable. Following months of repression by prison guards, which included closing down all communal areas and seizing personal possessions, the inmates in Bishkek Detention Center 1 rioted, slashing their wrists and burning their possessions. As a last-ditch protest, over 1,000 prisoners nationwide went on hunger strike, sewing their mouths shut with metal wire so they could not be force-fed. A warning, the following images are quite graphic. The hunger strike lasted nearly 2 weeks before a spokesman for the inmates said they had taken food and entered negotiations with prison authorities.
Great heavens! What kind of radio show is this?
It's like the best show ever!
Do you like being a participant in the watering can of the flowers of freedom throughout the world?
The medium is the message, means that the medium is the thing which is making the difference. in all, every discussion you ever hear since the 60s about TV, for example, is it good, is it bad, terrible, wonderful, the discussion hinges around what's on TV. And people say, well, television is terrible, it just shows violence. And then somebody else says, no, television is wonderful, those nature shows and news from far away and masterpiece theater. This is a stupid argument. What McLuhan meant by the media is the message is he meant that it doesn't matter what you put on TV. TV is TV. It has an intrinsic nature. And whether you're showing National Geographic specials or slasher movies, TV will do what it does. It has certain qualities, just like driving a car or skiing. Certain muscles are going to be exercised, certain perceptual systems enhanced, others suppressed. And it's very hard for us to understand this because we have accepted this media so thoroughly into our life. But in fact, it is shaping our value systems in ways that are very hard for us to suspect or even detect. I mean, television, for example, it's a drug. It has a series of measurable physiological parameters that are as intrinsically its signature as the parameters of heroin are its signature. I mean, you sit somebody down in front of a TV set and turn it on, 20 minutes later come back, sample their blood pressure, their eye movement rate, blood is pooling in their rear end, their breathing takes on a certain quality, the stare reflex sets in. I mean, they are thoroughly zoned on a drug. And when you think about the fact that the average American watches 6.5 hours of television a day, imagine if a drug had been introduced in 1948 that we all spent 6.5 hours per day on average watching. And the one thing about drugs in their defense is that it's very hard to diddle the message. A drug is a mirror. But television isn't a mirror. Television is a billboard, and anybody who pays their money can put their message into the trip. This is an extraordinarily insidious situation. What McLuhan wanted to become, I think, was the founder of a general new sophistication about media. And he was essentially parodied to get to death by, guess what? Media. They made of him an icon of cultural incomprehensibility. Not since Einstein have you been so pre-programmed in advance to believe you ain't gonna understand this guy. And that's what they said about McLuhan, and consequently his message and his insight failed. We will have to reinvent McLuhan around the turn of the century because we are producing forms of media of such interactive power and potential social impact that we're going to have to go back and rethink all of this.
Now, go find the others.com.
Yeah, man, I tell you what, that dang old internet, man, you just go on there and point and click, 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 click. It's real easy, man.